Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. I'm very pleased today to welcome Toby Heaps to the podcast. Toby is the CEO and co-founder of Corporate Knights Inc., a media company that produces corporate rankings, research reports, and financial product ratings based on corporate sustainability performance. Its best-known rankings include the best 50 corporate citizens in Canada and the Global 100 most sustainable corporations. It also publishes Corporate Knights magazine, which focuses on how companies, markets, and governments are advancing social and environment sustainability worldwide. It calls itself the magazine for clean capitalism. Well, thank you very much, Toby, for taking the time today to speak to the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Thank you, Fergal. It's a pleasure to be on.
So can you tell me a little bit about your background and Corporate Knights?
Sure. So I co-founded Corporate Knights in 2002, coming out of the mutual fund journalism space and being interested in writing about sort of what the big struggles of the day were and the role that business played, with the sort of notion that the big problems that we have in our world for society, inequality, climate change, the only way we find a solution for those problems is if we engage the power of business. And so that's really a sentiment that animates everything we do.
Right. That's, well, you're coming up for your 15th anniversary then. You've been at this for a while.
Yeah. It's surprising how much and little progress has been made at the same time.
Yes. So what can you tell me a little bit about the scope of Corporate Knights activities?
Sure. So we do three things. The thing we're probably more broadly known for is Corporate Knights magazine, the media company which publishes numerous rankings, including the Global 100 Most Sustainable Companies in the World, which has been an index and is announced annually in January in Davos during the World Economic Forum each year since 2005. And we also power the Newsweek Green Rankings for the past several years and a whole suite of other rankings dealing with companies and MBA programs and cities and countries, always on sustainability factors and always, for the most part, trying to come up with methodologies that are as fair and accurate as possible given the state of things,
right?
And that are replicable by third parties. So we have the magazine media. We have a sort of public policy group called the Council for Clean Capitalism, which is a group of leading Canadian CEOs of some global corporations as well, who want to lobby on the highest common denominator plane, not for particular transactional issues for their own company, but for macro issues that will help to align the economy with the version of clean capitalism that we espouse. And then the third thing is research around creating databases and software that make it easier for investors to invest more intentionally around their other goals, not just their financial goals, but their social and environmental goals and their other preferences in that regard.
Right. Really important work then in terms of measuring what's really going on. And I suppose trying to assess what are the important indicators and what really reflects genuine, sustainable, important sustainability work. We'll come on to that in a moment, talking about maybe the Global 100, but I'm interested in this idea of clean capitalism. What is that?
It's a system of capitalism not unlike what Adam Smith imagined and desired. It's a system of capitalism that is not just about the invisible hand, but it's about the invisible hand being guided by moral sentiments as well, so not in a moral vacuum. And technically how we define clean capitalism is it's a system where the prices fully reflect the ecological, social, economic costs and benefits, and that the marketplace actors, whether they're customers or investors or other actors, the marketplace actors are fully aware of the consequences of their marketplace decisions. So if you're buying a t-shirt, you know what that means. If you're buying a bushel of apples, you have an idea of what message you send. And underpinning that sort of latter part of the definition, so there's just sort of the prices tell the whole story and people know what's going on. Underpinning the latter part, people know what's going on, is a sort of an idea that every decision you make in the marketplace is like a vote. And so you're voting for something, you're supporting something. And we're actually seeing this become a lot more focused and crystallized in this sort of post-Trump, or in this Trump era that we're living in now, with people really on both sides of the ledger starting to reward and penalize companies and being that are crystallized by their affinity with Trump or non-affinity.
Right, that's a very great goal and a big challenge as well, I guess. For so long, externalities of all kinds haven't been included in the pricing in any way or in small ways. How are we doing on this journey?
I think if we were going across America on a road trip and we started out in California, I think we'd be somewhere over the Great Plains right now. Maybe in, maybe somewhere near Casper, Wyoming, and then heading for out into Nebraska and into the Midwest. But I think we're definitely at the first leg of the journey, and certain things are starting to become more clear. But it also is interesting how it's like a merry-go-round, and we sort of will figure out what we need to do and then get distracted and then maybe 10 years later come back to it. But where we've seen some progress, I think, is you now have around 60 countries that have some form of carbon pricing that is substantive, that's in place now or will be in place. So that's the mother of all externalities, and we are starting to tackle that through various means, including pricing. So I think that's encouraging. I think the other thing that we're starting to understand, but not maybe do as well, is this sort of theory of nudge economics and the sort of think fast, the Daniel Kahneman sort of behavioral psychology. We're starting to understand the importance of the informal elements of motivating mass amounts of people towards various behaviors that are more compatible with a civilization that lasts. And I think that part is less developed than the sort of literature around how do we price externalities and what are the sort of politics that make that happen. But I think it's equally important, and it's interesting to see the sort of the work that's emerging there.
Are you optimistic about progress on carbon pricing?
Yeah, I think the carbon price, along with the economics of clean energy, which now in over 30 countries, the cheapest way to add power to the grid is solar, and that's not a trend that's going to turn back. I feel like the economics will take care of our fossil dependency. The pricing can help as an accelerant, and I think the pricing can also serve as a model. We've done pricing on things like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide to clean up the air in lakes, particularly in North America, where it was really successful, but in other places as well. And I think this idea about pricing externalities is getting a broader currency through carbon pricing. We're seeing it through congestion pricing and innovative ways to pricing water that don't necessarily create negative biases against farmers, especially small land-holding farmers. So I think carbon pricing. We're probably not going to see a massive push on carbon pricing, although you never know, from the federal government in the US. But then we've never really seen that, and had the election gone the other way. I think the emails from John Podesta were fairly revealing in that they didn't think there was much political currency to really push a national carbon pricing program in the US. But we have it in the 60 countries, and China critically and India critically are among those countries. And those are really the countries at the margins that are moving the global economy right now. And so that's where the growth is, that's where the movement is, that's where the action is, and that's also where the carbon pricing is.
Right. So you measured optimism.
Yeah, I think no, it kind of progresses in fits and starts, but clearly we've made a lot of progress that a lot of people may not have suspected or even thought possible as recently as, 2009.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about the, tell me about the Global 100 and what this is and what really does it measure?
Sure. So there's a lot of measurements of companies and rankings, who's the biggest company, who's the best employer, but there wasn't a measurement of who was the most sustainable. And admittedly, when you do a ranking, you have to dumb it down a little bit in terms of title. And it's called the Global 100 Most Sustainable Companies in the World. And what it really is, it's the best out of the large companies on a range of measures done in a relative best of sector manner, not in a context-based manner, which some people have been critical of and made valid points about. And so what we're trying to do, though, is we're trying to, without being sector, but without discriminating by sectors, aside from sectors that are clearly identifiable with, having a primary consequence of their activities, killing people, including weapons and tobacco, with the only two that are excluded. We rank all sectors and we look at all companies on the range of quantitative metrics that we can get data for, and we try and do it as fairly as possible. So if you have a company that's on the Global 100, what that tells you is it tells you that company, relative to its peers, is doing a decent job on its resource productivity, so its use and emissions of things like carbon and energy and water and waste, and also at the same time doing a decent job respecting the social contract. And the social contract is a sort of metaphor for how you treat your employees, so things like safety, how inclusive you are as a company, so things like the diversity of your executive leadership and your boards in terms of female representation, how aligned-tuned your governance is in terms of your linkage of executive compensation to sustainability targets, which was one of the litmus tests to whether or not a company is really, really serious about sustainability. And things like whether or not the companies are paying their fair share of taxes, measured cash tax over their profits over a 5-year period against their peers. And so we've really honed our measurements, and we are big consumers of sustainability data from the various providers, Thomson Reuters, Bloomberg, and now FactSet as well, and CDP. And we really try to make the best use of all of the quantitative data that is in the public domain, even if it's through private distributors like Bloomberg and Thomson Reuters, but it's just disclosed by the companies in the public domain. And to get an idea about who is leading among their large company peers over 2 billion market cap on these important factors. And we look at things like CEO to average worker pay. And a lot of the factors we look at have become front page factors. You see the financial press focusing on things like gender equality or equity on the governance structure. You see the huge focus on CEO to average worker pay, especially in this era of massive inequity and populist uprisings against it. And it's really interesting to see the differences. I mean, it's companies, countries, industries, there's lots of differences, and there's companies that will shirk their regional biases and lead in some cases, on gender diversity, like companies in Japan, where they tend not to have a lot of female leaders in management or on the board. There's some companies that are, in the US that will tend to have relatively low CEO to average worker pay, where CEO to average worker pay is sky high compared to the rest of the world. And so you'll see different trends. There's companies in the oil patch that will have amazing resource productivities. And so there's all sorts of things you see. And it's a work in progress. We acknowledge that. We're always trying to improve it while retaining some continuity, because it is used by benchmark and watched closely by a number of companies. But we try to do as best job as we can and recognize that it's a work in progress.
Great. Sounds very important work. What about the relativity factor, as you say? I mean, how well are companies doing overall? Because you could have the number one company for 10 years in a row, but it might not be doing a lot. But relative to others, it's doing a tremendous amount. How do you factor in absolute measures or ideas about what we expect from companies in terms of
Sure.
minimum levels or, you know, or really where companies really need to be?
So every metric is different, and we've thought about this a fair bit. And let's take greenhouse gases to start. So there's science-based targets for greenhouse gases, which will, you know, there's various ways to arrive at that. One sort of crude but not impractical way is at a global level, we roughly need to, if you look at GDP growth projections and greenhouse gas scenarios that get us in a 2-degree scenario, is a global economy, we need to have a roughly sort of factor 4 increase in terms of our carbon productivity globally. So that works out to something in the neighborhood of about 6% per year, just under 6% per year. So that would mean that each year you're making 6% more revenue for every ton of greenhouse gases you emit. So if the whole economy was doing that, then we're on track. So one of the things we look at is we look at over a 3-year period, how many of the companies are increasing their carbon productivity by 6% year over year. And, of the economy, of the global 100, sometimes it'll go up, sometimes it'll go down, depending on things like commodity prices that drive revenue. So that's one indicator you can look at. For things like tax, well, if we went back in time 50 years ago, corporations used to pay about half of all taxes collected in a country, with the rest coming from people. And now that corporations pay less than a quarter of taxes in most OECD countries. So it's went down. And so you know, it's hard to say what is the fair benchmark. If you were to sort of say it's half of all taxes, and then you were to look at what the tax rate has to be nationally in order for that to work out, you know, maybe it's higher than the blended rate of 30%, maybe it's 45% or something like that. But the way we look at taxes, we say that the current statutory framework, if it says 32% of profits are supposed to be paid in tax, then we look and see, okay, out of cash tax paid, you know, how close is it to 32%? So we use that as a context. But some would argue that that's not a fair context because the states that levy taxes have, in some senses, been captured and influenced by the companies that pay them to drive taxes to a lower percent, which results in you know, not a fair context for what ideally would be sustainable. So that question of what is the sustainable rate of tax is an interesting one. It's the legal rate has definitely come down a lot, and the actual rate has also come down quite a bit as well, because of all the loopholes that exist that some creative companies, some more aggressive than others, take advantage of. Things like safety. What's an ideal, you know, indicator on fatalities? I would think zero, but you know, you could talk about that. On injuries, again, you know, a lot of companies shoot for zero injuries, but it's not realistic for many industries, and you know, gender equity is 50% female in the board. Is that a good number? We that's what we set as the target, but you see some companies with 55% female. Is that bad? So each one, you know, CEO to average worker pay, there's been a lot of work done on this. Some say 8-to-1 is a sort of a max ratio. You know, the average for the MSCI All Country World Index is 114-to-1. So there's, I think each of these indicators, you can come up with things. There's an initiative called the Future Fit Business Benchmark. So the Future Fit Benchmark is a great initiative to really get at these important metrics and add some context around what it would take for a company to be sustainable. And so there are some great initiatives, and we're watching them closely. And over time, ideally, we could evolve our ranking from a best of sector to a ranking against an ideal benchmark. At the moment, though, we're doing a relative ranking.
Right. Challenging work. And I guess another major question is, how do you measure or reflect the relative importance of an issue like climate change or many of the aspects with diversity, for example, or with pay ratios?
Yeah. So great question. I think the simple answer is it's not easy. And most attempts to do weighting schemes introduce multiple biases. And so we have opted in the spirit of coming up with as objective an approach as possible, we have opted to do equal weight. And we wholly recognize that scope 1-2 carbon productivity for a bank is way less of an issue than scope 1-2 carbon productivity for a utility company, by orders of magnitude, more than one order of magnitude probably. And so we've recently been looking at an interesting way to come up with an objective rules-based way to weight each indicator that isn't sort of, just sort of sticking your finger in the wind, and taking some, obvious kind of point and saying, well, overweight this or underweight this. And so the way that it's kind of maybe a little bit difficult to describe in words, but the idea is there's hundreds of metrics out there. We primarily focus on 14 that are broadly available. So we're looking at a new system for weighting metrics where instead of looking at the sector to start, we look at the indicator. So we look at, say, greenhouse gases and say, in which sector do the majority or the in which sectors do the majority of greenhouse gases occur? So maybe utilities might account for 20% of all greenhouse gases, which would mean the utilities sector for greenhouse gases would be ranked number one in the utility sector. And so the idea would be that you would weight most heavily the metrics which have the biggest footprints in the particular sectors. And then you would, for non, there's various types of metrics. There's sort of integer metrics like greenhouse gases that can go zero to infinity. There's percent metrics like percent women on the board, that we would be looking for higher percents, things like employee turnover. And then there are some yes no metrics which we tend to steer clear from, aside from the executive compensation link to sustainability. And again, that translates into a percent metric. So that's what we're looking at implementing. It's a pretty major operation to do it coherently, and we're working with a leading quant business school that is assisting us on that front, and are hopeful that we'll find an elegant, transparent, objective way to weight indicators in accordance with the size and importance of those indicators to particular industries.
Right. Now, you mentioned that it's primarily a relative set of indicators. How well are companies doing over the last few years?
Well, I think, I mean, if you look at sometimes over the last few years, it looks like we're going the wrong way on things like carbon productivity. We're now, in some cases, at least among, globally, we're emitting less carbon per unit of GDP. But for publicly traded companies, we're emitting a slightly more carbon, just slightly more, just over the last few years. And that could be chalked up to a number of factors, and including maybe the purchasing power parity currency conversion method that we use. So I would say things like the things where we've seen dramatic progress are the metrics like executive remuneration link to sustainability factor. That's gone from almost nowhere to 80% of the Global 100 companies do that today. I think CEO to average worker pay is still way out of whack in most of the world, with parts of Western Europe and Japan accepted. And when I say world, I mean sort of mostly sort of OECD countries, although we see it way out of whack in places like Brazil and Mexico and China as well. And that's an indicator that's really driving a lot of outrage against our current capitalist system, as you see people in the streets all over, and it's a favorite metric for people to focus on. The tax
Right.
metric has over the last 10 years or even 20 years has trended downwards, but we've seen it start to pick up over the last few years in many countries, and I think that's a reaction to the G20 really focusing on cracking down on some of these loopholes in the OECD, and a little bit less of a sort of cowboy culture within the CFO's offices that were letting things get out of hand before. In terms of globally, whatever's going on in the global cohort of companies that we track that account for most of the publicly traded companies in the world by size, there's a fair degree of mirroring for the economy at large. And we know for the economy at large, there's some big things that are going well. We're starting to decouple growth from greenhouse gas emissions. Last 2 years, We have had GDP growth and greenhouse gas emission reductions. Not a huge gap, small growth and a small decrease, but that's all nonetheless quite notable. And that's probably one of the most important metrics because that really drives a lot of the other things. We're still, if we look at things like planetary boundaries, we're still transgressing or close to transgressing a number of critical planetary boundaries. And so clearly, whatever we are doing, the sum of whatever we're doing is not enough to protect life and the life-giving services that our planet offers, the critical life-giving services that our planet offers. So I think our work is still cut out for us, but I think the good news is that the thing that has put us most in peril, our fossil fueled economy, is now the sun is setting on it, and the name of the game is to make that happen as quickly and justly as possible, so that we don't shoot over any cliffs or crash through any tipping points that it'll be hard to recover from.
Well, that's some good news there. We take it wherever we can, but that does sound like an important step and an important measure. Now, here's a difficult question for you, Toby. I mean, how useful is this listing and who reads it and what happens as a result of it? Is that something you can track?
Sure. So the companies read it carefully. I think employees read it carefully. It hasn't really been used as broadly, and we haven't targeted as broadly consumers. But we noticed we co-publish it with Forbes, and it's one of the most read stories on Forbes of the year when we co-publish it with them. So there's a clear business interest in this list. For instance, there's sort of more interest in this list than the Forbes list they publish of the most innovative companies in the world. And innovation is a pretty big catchword. So I think that's interesting. I think when I talk to CEOs that do well in the list and I ask them, how the list is helpful for them, they say it's tremendously helpful for morale and engagement with their employees. And interestingly, a lot of the best companies in the world have discovered that one of the keys to having their employees engaged is having their employees feel proud about the company. And one of the keys to an employee feeling proud about the company is feeling that their company is doing something to make the world a better place. And this ranking is really focused on a lot of those on a lot of metrics that feed into that narrative, into that story. And so it is something that I think the if we had to say, there's of 100% of the value that the ranking creates, probably 70% of the value of the ranking creates is by making people that work for the companies that make the ranking feel proud. And then that being a sort of a virtuous cycle within the company in terms of company providing more resources to maintain their leadership and improve their leadership on this factor that their employees care about, which motivates their employees to be more productive, ultimately, which ultimately results in more productive employees and more successful companies. Investors look at it. We have some products that are licensed to create investment opportunities. The Global 100 Index is really an experiment in some ways to see if you don't make a sector bias, do the better companies on sustainability over time outperform the broad sort of market. And now we have over 12 years of history with the Global 100 and a pretty fair, non-sector in a sector neutral way. And the Global 100 Index has markedly outperformed the benchmark, the MSCI All Country World Index, by a little over 1% annualized each year over a 12-year period, and has been ahead of its benchmark without interruption since the beginning of 2006. So I think that is a powerful exponent to the thesis that the more sustainable companies can perform as well as the market in general. And in this case, we have a slight outperformance.
Right, well, that counts, particularly when you take into account fees and you look at this over a number of years. I think there's some very compelling evidence now about the various ways in which sustainable companies not only generate better financial returns, but actually generate better investment returns as well. And that's quite exciting news. And I think there's a lot more to happen there. And investors certainly seem to be paying a lot of attention to that, which is only good. What other measures would you include, Toby, if somebody wants to get a full picture of a company's sustainability initiatives?
Well, I mean, I think for every company, you look at the core kind of thing. And you know, for a utility, you want to look at what percent of power they're generating from renewable sources. For a retailing company, you want to look at, ideally, the metrics are hard to get. You know, first of all, you want to make sure they're publishing all their factories, like Gap recently did. But you also want to have an idea of what percent of their overall workforce, including their supply chain, is paid a living wage and how that living wage is defined. And if they're implicated in any kind of forced or child labor, if they have the proper sort of management systems to take care of that. And there are good sources like Know the Chain, which does a really good job focusing on IT, apparel, and prominent food companies in that regard.
So, are you suggesting,
it depends on the company and the industry. But you really want to look at what is that company, not you know, I don't care if they're using recycled paper at the bank. I want to know, you know, what's their power asset financing mix? What percent is renewable and what percent is fossil? So that those types of things, kind of cutting to what is the core impact of that sector, and then getting the best metric or proxy for that metric.
Right. Now, is that information you provide? Because it sounds quite detailed. You know, if I was looking at, you say, retail and energy, completely different kinds of measures. And you're right, you know, recycling paper is something that, you know, or just some of these things that you can think of that you think, oh, yes, that makes sense. But actually, you've really got to be thinking of the two or three, the really biggest drivers. So is there some place that, you know, that you can get this kind of information that identify what are the key drivers per industry and how they rank?
So we've done a fair bit of research around this. Yeah, I think the short answer is there actually is an amazingly impressive amount of user-friendly differentiated lists about these things. Like if you know, care about child labor, forced labor, you go to Know the Chain. If you care about animal welfare, you go to Business Benchmark for Animal Welfare. If you care about climate policy, public policy influence and lobbying, you go to Influence Map. If you care about companies providing nutritious food, you go to Access to Nutrition Index. If you care about companies that are providing affordable medicine for pressing developing country diseases, you go to Access to Medicine Index. And so there's about 30 different indexes, you know, that deal with palm oil to seafood to deforestation around specific themes that are really well done, really transparent, done by organizations with really good credentials that are quite trustworthy and transparent in methodology that you can use. For our part, when we publish our rankings, we make a spreadsheet freely available with all the scores for the Global 100 companies that people can see on the metrics that we track. A lot of those metrics I was just discussing are not yet integrated into the Global 100 because they're more sector-specific metrics that are not broadly applicable across the economy. But they are integrated into our investment software, and we do have an eye to wanting to integrate them into our actual rankings, such as the Global 100 and the Best 50, as part of that process that I described earlier.
Great. That's very interesting. That's clearly very important due to the different factors within each industry, and I think that's a very useful list of sources of information for that kind of material. So I've read some figures, Toby, that suggest that 90 companies cause 2/3 of man-made carbon emissions. And I'm just wondering how that affects how you think about measuring sustainability, and should there be some way of focusing on maybe these companies? I know you do a listing of the top 100, but does that raise questions about what other kind of measures or lists that you might put together?
Sure. So I think two things come out of it. One, that's instructive as to why we would want to weight the measurement of greenhouse gases much higher in those industries that account for the vast majority of carbon emissions, particularly utilities on a scope 1 and 2, being the sort of accounting for the lion's share. I think the S&P 500 utilities account for something like 40% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So definitely it speaks to putting a large emphasis on the weighting. So the preponderance of the weight in those sectors is placed on greenhouse gases. In terms of other lists, we have in the past done some lists around sort of like the biggest greenhouse gas polluters, the toxic 50 most largest toxic polluters, and there is room for those lists, and we're working right now on doing a few more of those lists, but we haven't done them as consistently. And I guess it's sort of I think it's important to do those lists, and there were NGOs historically who focused on publishing those kinds of lists who are a little less active, and it's a really important space that needs to be filled. And we are happy to provide assistance and guidance. And if nobody fills it, we may fill that space again. So the thinking, so some groups like Bank Track do a really good job focusing on what, or do a pretty good job at focusing on which financial institutions are linked to financing some of these more controversial, impactful projects on the environment. And so a consideration for us, so is we want to maximize change, and it's the messenger for and the message matter. And so if companies understand us, that companies understand corporatites is, I think, what we strive to be understood as a fair arbiter of who is leading and also who is lagging. And our editorial will hit on both of those points. But we have a slant to our coverage is we're more looking for the solutions than the problems. And I think if we don't get the balance right, if we're seeing more as a kind of Greenpeace banging companies over the head about where all the problems are, then the message about the solutions may get lost in the muck. So it's not about ignoring the problems. We definitely clear-eyed about the problems. It's not about giving a pass to big transgressors, and we have a column called Heroes and Zeros, and the zeros we focus in on the biggest transgressor of the last quarter. But there is an important role to shine the light on who the real laggards are, and it's probably worth us taking the risk to our reputation to go and do that if nobody steps up to the plate to do it.
But it
hasn't been done, but there's a gap right now in the marketplace for that.
Right. Interesting. Now, what would the tipping point be or look like, do you think, when it comes to sustainability? There's been tremendous momentum. And I'm just wondering, what point would you think that what kind of things would need to happen that you feel that sustainability is really, truly embedded?
That's interesting. Well, I guess at a starting point, you would have the sustainability information, key bits of it for key industries and companies would be reported in the same timely and comparable way that financials are currently reported. That would that's a necessary condition. And if that's happening, then that means a lot of other things are happening too, and the marketplace has the information to properly process. I guess it would mean culturally, in terms of corporate culture, human culture, there would be a broad awareness, sort of how there is for recycling in say North America, in any case where I'm familiar, where people just, the idea that you would throw a aluminum can into the garbage is almost repulsive to people. And that's really kind of something in the last 30 years. So the idea that you would just chuck your coffee cup out the window of your car, you know, be a litter bug is just completely kind of taboo. And so I think we'll start to see certain things, other interactions with the environment to be taboo. You know, the idea that you would have big package for something will just be looked at as ludicrous, you know, with wasteful packaging. The idea that you would have waste, you know, be wasting resources in some way will be seen as just kind of ludicrous. And so I think when we see a bit of a cultural mind shift to, more conservation oriented sort of conscientious culture around our consumption of resources, that will tell us that we're heading somewhere. And so those are sort of maybe hard things to put out. You know, those are sound more like qualitative things than measurements. If we were going to look at actual numbers, I think it would mean that we have a multi-decade of GDP growth, as flawed a measure it is, coinciding with a multi-decade greenhouse gas reduction. That will tell us. I think it would, I know, on a quantitative level, if you were to look at the key planetary boundaries that Jonas Rockström and his colleagues have laid out, we would be stepping back from those boundaries that we're most precipitously at the moment. I think you would see things like, hopefully my child, who's 9 months, will never have to fill up a car with gas, not because he's some sort of bourgeois, which I doubt that will ever happen, but because, you know, the combustion engine will be a relic of the past, you know, in 15 years. So it would be things like that.
Ah, interesting, interesting. Now, I spoke to EcoVadis, and they do measures of various sustainability measures, particularly focusing on the supply chain. And one of the points that came up in the conversation was about changes that are scalable. And, you know, you can have lots of changes within an organization that are important and good and so forth. And I'm just wondering what you think might be one or two changes that could take place that could be really scalable.
From a system architecture or from a business practice?
A business practice.
And from a regulatory perspective or just from the perspective of a business, voluntary perspective?
Yeah, from the perspective of business.
I guess the, one thing that we've been seeing catch fire is the move towards being 100% renewable powered. There's a sort of renewable energy coalition, and you have Google and some big companies like that shifting over and making, you know, Tesla 100% renewable powered. So that's really, there's a lot of things you can do, but if we shift the energy economy from fossil to renewable entirely, that's a decent chunk of everything that we have to do. So companies can do that. Companies are doing that. There's a structure to do it. There's a reputational reward to it. And there's also some sort of energy security potential benefits. So I would say shifting to zero carbon, 100% zero carbon energy, and including using flexible mechanisms where necessary to do that for big companies, that seems to be, you know, pretty easy and scalable, very relatively easy to do and scalable. And if all companies did that, it would add up to something significant.
Right. That's interesting. Just following on from that, I'm just wondering, you mentioned regulation. To what extent, I mean, regulation clearly, and there's been some important regulatory initiatives, I know, in the United States in the last few years, has been a major driver of many corporate sustainability initiatives. I'm wondering to what extent you think their corporate sustainability initiatives are now being driven by a business rationale and less, you know, regulatory and risk avoidance, shall we say?
So I think we cannot overstate the importance of having a good referee on the playing field, and the government is the referee, and the rule book are the regulations, and we cannot overstate the importance of having a valid rule book and a good referee. Absent that, I think we risk Hobbesian type of outcomes in many scenarios. So I think we should distinguish from businesses that are smart and self-enlightened enough to see the long-term trajectory of the playbook and the enforcement of the referee, and businesses that are short-sighted and short-termist and narrow-minded and do not see the larger trajectory of the evolution we're seeing on the regulatory rule book and the referee enforcement. And so you might have a case where you have a certain country, a large country, elect a certain individual who may not seem the most sympathetic to the sustainability agenda, such as the neighbor to the south of the 49th parallel of my country. And some businesses may interpret that as a sort of carte blanche to go and do whatever they want and throw all these sustainability programs, energy efficiency and whatnot down the toilet and cozy back up to polluting and wasteful and carbon intensity and things of that ilk. And I would say that those businesses will probably be short-sighted and narrow-minded, because the pendulum of history sort of shows that it swings one way, swings back the other. But the long-term arc is quite clear, and so I think businesses that are doing things, even if it looks like they're doing it on a voluntary basis, often they're doing it against the context and expectation of what the trajectory of the rule book and the referee enforcement is going to be. And sure, there's lots of wiggle room for leadership up beyond that, but I think we delude ourselves if we think that the major driving force of this stuff is sort of just corporate goodwill. Sometimes there'll be a stakeholder case for that, but the regulatory, the rule book and the referee, the importance of them cannot be overstated, I don't think.
Right. And given the current context in the United States, what hopes have you got for the sustainability agenda over the next few years? There's talk about China taking up the mantle. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways we're... as ironic as it may sound, if you care about sustainability, we're all Chinese now. And, with 1.6 billion people, a long-term perspective, and a burning political imperative to do something about dirty air in the capitals and large city centers, China sees sustainability, the green agenda, is its opportunity to take the mantle of leadership, global leadership, from the United States. And this is a geostrategic and a domestic issue at the highest order, at the highest level in that country. And I'm really happy that that's the case, because it almost makes what happens in the U.S. A rounding error at the moment.
Right. And you're optimistic that the vision, the Chinese vision and their leadership will be a positive?
Well, that's a bigger question. I'm terrified and optimistic at the same time. I'm optimistic that the Chinese will, unlike the Japanese in many cases, will be honorable global stewards of the global commons, environmental commons, not just within their own country, like the Japanese were good, but in other countries as well over the long term. There won't be a completely green record, but there'll be less incongruence between what they do at home and what they do abroad, where they're dissimilar to the model of other rich nations of the last 100 years. But at the same time, I'm terrified on the sort of looming kind of big brother invasions of privacy, matter of censorship, the reality of censorship being the matter of an algorithm. And the Chinese certainly don't inspire a huge amount of hope on some of those levels. So, how the system will evolve is they mature and grow in wealth and integration with the rest of the world is the sort of $64,000 question, or maybe it's the 9 billion person question of the 21st century.
Thank you, Toby. Thanks. So what are your aspirations for Corporate Knights over the next 5 to 10 years, Toby?
Sure. So we'll continue to do what we do on the magazine, chronicling who's leading, who's lagging with rankings and stories. And I would really like to get at the nub of this question, which is, what if the 500 million people who are fortunate enough to have money to invest in the market, who control collectively $100 trillion of investments, what if these 500 million people's wealth reflected their personal values? What would the world look like? And so a lot of what we're focused on, at Corporate Knights, is putting in place the infrastructure that will enable us to answer that question with Right. respect to making it easy for investors to identify and define their values and then apply them in an easy, non-costly way.
Well, there does seem to be quite a bit of momentum there as well. Wish you the very best success with that, Toby, and I thank you so much for taking the time to speak to the sustainability agenda today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Fergal. It's been a pleasure, and enjoyed it. And look forward to staying in touch.
Thanks, Toby. Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.